The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Sarah Crown, and welcome to the third day of the Edinburgh International Book Festival. The clouds have rolled in, but spirits are still high on the festival site, and we're joined on the podcast by three of the authors from today's bustling programme. Nell Freudenberger's novel The Newlyweds has been garnering high praise on the other side of the Atlantic. It tells the story of a Bangladeshi woman who marries an American engineer whom she met online. Zan Brooks asked her whether she saw the book as a love story or a deconstruction of marriage.
I'm not sure either. I mean, it's the story of this woman who I met on an airplane 5 years ago. And although the things that happen in the book are not what happened to her, the character is very much based on her. What I was fascinated with in her was this sort of seed of this desire to go somewhere else and make a completely different life for herself, something that ran counter to her culture and everything she'd been raised to be expected to do. She did something completely different, and that's what initially fascinated me.
Which is kind of the American dream, but just transplanted to the 21st century, isn't it?
Well, and I guess maybe it's a bit of a deconstruction of the American dream, because the America she finds when she arrives is, of course, not the America she knew from television. I was struck when I met this young woman that she had grown up watching some of the shows that my father wrote when I was growing up in Los Angeles. He wrote cop shows, sort of procedural dramas.
Which ones?
He wrote Cagney and Lacey and Spencer for Hire, and she watched a show called The Fall Guy, which was one of my dad's first jobs when we arrived from New York to Los Angeles. He'd been a theater director in New York.
It almost sounds like you felt a kind of responsibility for her in the America that had been represented to her.
Well, and the America that she found is one that had changed so much since she was a little girl, you know, watching those television shows. I mean, and Rochester in particular, I think I wouldn't have set the book there. She did happen to live there, but it was a place I knew because my grandparents were from there and I'd grown up going there, so it was convenient in that way. But it also is one of these industrial failing American cities with big corporations like Xerox and Kodak. My grandfather worked for Gannett newspapers, and now these corporate campuses are just kind of ghost towns, and so it seemed like the perfect place to set a sort of 21st century immigrant American story.
I suppose in approaching this kind of material, the two obvious routes through it would be culture clash comedy or marital hell. And yet you go a completely different way. Was it important for you to kind of resist those easy avenues of expression?
I wish I did. I wish I knew the way my dad used to. He would have a sort of cork board with these post-its on it for every act and scene. And once he had that, he said he could relax and just write. And novels just don't work that way. I mean, I had her voice first. I remember the day I sat down, and I'd been sort of feeling around for another book and wrote this section about her going out to the mailbox to look for her green card. She had a new mailbox. I remember my grandmother telling me stories about boys coming around in open cars using a baseball bat to knock the mailbox off its post. And this was sort of that story, and the idea of her checking every day for the green card that got me started. And once I had that voice, I mean, what you just sort of know that that's the voice for the book. In this case, it was complicated because I don't think I would have done it if she hadn't given me permission. So I wrote about 50 pages, and then with my heart in my mouth, I called my friend up and asked her if she would mind if I loosely based this novel on her life. And she said, I don't mind as long as you get all the details about Islam correct.
I know you spent a lot of time teaching abroad, which I guess gave you a basis for this book, but did you have to do a lot of research on Islam as well?
And I've taught a tiny bit in Delhi, but that's nothing like Bangladesh, and I've only been to Bangladesh for a few weeks with this friend. Of course, I read, you know, a lot of history. I read a lot about the war, and I of course read some books about Islam, but I think that truly the it was this kind of 5 year long process of interviewing this woman that was most of the research for the book. There's also a really wonderful book by these two academics. Their names are Betsy Hartman and James Boyce, and they wrote a book, and they were in Bangladesh living in a village just after the war, and they wrote a kind of chronicle of the people they met there and their year there. So that book was really important to me, and then also just talking to Farah and her family and the trip I took with them. much more than any reading I did.
One of the central ideas in the book is the idea of marriage as a transaction, as a contract that has to be honoured and adhered to and kind of worked at to be propped up. Does that reflect your own view of marriage as a married woman?
I don't think that George and Amina's marriage in the book is so different from a marriage where the courtship happens in the Western way. I mean, the courtship was completely different, but once you're married, you know, it takes work no matter how you got together. I mean, people are always citing that statistic about arranged marriages working out more often than our type. And I'm not sure that that's... I'm sure that statistic really makes sense, because in a culture where marriages are arranged, it's also a place where divorce is going to be less tolerated. But what was fascinating to me was that this young woman had taken the tradition of arranged marriage and taken her knowledge of English and a bit of computer skills and basically arranged her own marriage.
Tell me about your own career path. You were lucky enough to be fated very, very early before you'd actually written a novel, and that you were championed by The New Yorker. You were profiled in Vogue and Elle. Was that purely a wonderful experience, or did that make you a little bit nervous or wary about how you were being marketed and how you were being presented to the world?
If it hadn't happened, I'm sure I wouldn't have been able to leave my job and write full time. It would have taken me much longer to write the books. So in that sense, it was lucky, but certainly the experience of it was not at all wonderful. I felt very much like a deer in headlights, and, you know, I'd just been doing my editorial assistant job, and there is, you know, when you imagine it happening, it sounds terrific, but the fact of it was more like not being ready at all. I mean, I'd written one story that I was comfortable showing to anybody, and everything I'd written before that was just absolute junk, you know, and the agent said, "You have a novel, right? You know, can you show us a novel?" And I did have a novel, but I knew, you know, I shouldn't show, at least, thank God, I was at least smart enough not to show that novel to anyone and to say I need some time to keep working.
I'm now wondering about parallels between your arrival as a writer and Amina's arranged marriage, almost the sense that you are both being sold as this complete ribboned and bowed package, this promise of quality that then had to be backed up. Is there any truth in that at all?
I think there's always some element of faking in my books, and because I think that a lot of fiction writing is stealing and faking. And I imagine, you know, as I grew up, you know, that there would be a time where it would really feel like I was the person that people said I was. And now I think that it's, you know, everyone is just pretending all the time. You know, you're pretending to be a parent, you're pretending to be a writer or a banker or, you know, whatever it is. The public stuff never gets more comfortable for me. Coming in and saying, "I'm, you know, where's the author's tent?" never feels quite natural. But
but I guess a writing career like a marriage is a life's work, isn't it? And it is that thing that on one level you're faking it and you're acting a role, but on the other level this is your life and this is what you are doing while you're here on Earth.
Yeah, there's a bit in the book about that, you know, of Mina imagining her parents' marriage, and it really is much more me imagining my parents' marriage. The thought of, I mean, there's nothing more, it's like the Delmore Schwartz story, there's nothing more interesting than imagining your parents kind of in their first, you know, few months as newlyweds, kind of going through the motions. And I thought in particular in this case it was interesting to think about this young woman's parents coming from the village and having, you know, the village models for the way that a husband and a wife behave toward each other, and suddenly finding themselves in Dhaka struggling to kind of make it in a new world and having these roles, you know, trying to figure out what their roles as modern people were, as husband and wife.
Two authors at very different points on their career paths are meeting up on stage today to talk about two novels sharing many unlikely similarities. Sion is an internationally acclaimed and multi-award-winning novelist and poet whose latest book, The Whispering Muse, newly translated from Icelandic into English, tells the story of Valdimar Haraldsson, an eccentric Icelander very interested in the link between the consumption of fish and the superiority of the Nordic race, who embarks on a voyage on a Danish merchant ship and encounters among the crew a hero from Greek mythology who spins tales every night about his time as a crew member on the Argo. Jess Richards is a debut novelist, the author of an astonishing and astonishingly good book called Snake Ropes. It's set on an island not dissimilar from St Kilda, but more remote, entirely cut off from the mainland, other than through occasional visitations from the tall men who trade with the islanders. It starts as a story of a missing three-year-old boy and turns into something odder and darker and completely absorbing. Okay, so having read both of your books, the first thing that I wanted to ask you about was the question of islands. For both of you, you viewed islands as sort of free zones for the subconscious, in that they're kind of safe zones where you can create whatever you like and then you leave it there because it's kind of safely bounded off.
I really wanted to set my first novel on an island because of the idea of a closed community. And it is partly because, you know, if you've got an island, you can make it as far away from anywhere that you want to, and in a way you've got more scope for the imagination as well, because a closed community can have all kinds of mythology and all kinds of strangeness going on that can make perfect sense to the people who live there, and then you've got the sense of, like, you know, the magic that could grow up over the years on an island culture, which is very cut off from everywhere else. So there's a huge scope to use the imagination, and that's really why I kind of went there.
Well, I'm from an island. I'm from Iceland. And when you grow up there in the north of the Atlantic, you understand it quite early on, you know, that you are there surrounded by sea, that in a way you're at the mercy of the bigger world. Mm. Because it's not only an island, I mean, it's a small nation, you know. So in a way, all stories taking place in our community are about being trapped, hoping to leave, or being invaded. Islands have been used as neutral grounds in international meetings. I mean, Iceland was the meeting place for Reagan and Gorbachev and for Fischer and Spassky.
And Jess, you mentioned mythology, this notion of islands kind of creating their own mythology, very specific individual mythologies, and both of you tackle myth in sort of different but kind of complementary ways, luckily for me, who's reading both the books. Jess, what you're doing is you're coming up with your own mythology. Is that a difficult thing to do? How did you manage that? I mean, some, you know, you've got Selkies, which obviously sort of part of a wider mythology, but some of the stuff's just invented.
Yes, some of it is invented, and I think I really wanted to borrow the Selkie myth because it's just stunningly beautiful and kind of timeless as well. But what I really found was, you know, what kind of informed the mythology was imagining this island and the location and the geology of it, and imagining the kinds of stories that an island with no solid religion that was very organised, what they would kind of imagine around them. So a rocky island to the north that's maybe got quite glittering rocks on it when the sun shines could become something quite strange, like, you know, there's five women on the island, this is the mythology, whose hair is all different colours and they're tangled together, and they're called the Glimmerers, and they fight, and their fights cause storms, and it's their hair being that tangled and then the sun shining on it that would make the very distant island glimmer.
Well, in my book, I'm taking advantage of a part of the Argonautica, the story of Jason, who went so famously to retrieve the Golden Fleece. And I think my book is an example of how you should take liberties with the great wealth of material that has been left for us by our ancestors. And when I was writing this book, I had to revisit the Greek-Roman myths. And it's, of course, like such an immense world, you know, that my job was most of the time to keep things away, you know. But one of the things that I discovered while I was writing it was that the original idea of gods was not gods as figures, gods as beings, but the original word in Greek for a god means a state of being.
Mm.
So, in that sense, the Greek gods have never left us, simply because the ocean is still there, the sky is still there, the thunder is still there, the rivers are still there, the corn still grows. So all the gods are still here, but we have to connect with them again, and we can do it by remembering those old stories.
The hero whom you sort of have plucked from Greek mythology and put into your own book is Caeneus, I think that's how you say the word. And what's interesting about Caeneus is that he or she has shifted from being a woman to being a man to eventually being something else entirely. And I wondered, I mean, obviously you're drawing your story, I presume, from reading Ovid and that kind of representation of the Argonauts in his metamorphosis.
Well, I think that's one of the great gifts of mythology. You know, the great things that we have inherited from mythology is the idea of the metamorphosis. For an author, it's a wonderful tool, you know. I mean, to have a character that actually was born a girl and metamorphosed into a titan of a man, you know, the most masculine of all men, and from there into a bird. This is such a wonderful thing to be allowed to depict and retell, you know.
Meanwhile, intellectual debate continues to wax in Charlotte Square Gardens. As you'd expect, this being Edinburgh, one of the main subjects for discussion is Scottish independence. Gordon Brown was here today to give his take. But Professor Michael Sandel of Harvard University, who's argued in his book What Money Can't Buy that the market can't meet all social needs, has been struck by the latest changes in the US presidential election.
I think the naming of Ryan can potentially be a clarifying moment in the presidential campaign. He has a very strong, unabashed, pro-market, anti-government position. He's offered a budget proposal, which is brave in many ways. It calls for privatizing Social Security and turning the Medicare health system into a voucher system. And this is the way he thinks that the federal government can save money over time. It will be very controversial, but I think it may sharpen the ideological character of the choice between Democrats and Republicans during this presidential campaign.
And would you still favor the Democrat position?
I'm in favor of Obama and the Democrats. I was before, and I am now since the naming of Ryan. But I think that it's possible that this will sharpen the ideological character of the debate. From Obama's point of view, it actually could help, not because Ryan isn't articulate and vigorous as a candidate. I think he'll be an effective candidate as a person. But I think it shifts the attention from the state of the economy, which is not so terrific and which does not help Obama, to the question of the future, the ideological alternatives between the parties. And if that's what the election is about, I think Obama will be helped.
And do you still think that, in a sense, it's a battle between a European ideal, the one that you yourself would write about, and an American ideal, the Republican one?
I wouldn't put it that way. Mr. Romney has used as a term of abuse in describing the Obama policy, European. It's European, as if that's a self-sufficient, freestanding pejorative. I don't think President Obama will want to cast the campaign as an American versus a European campaign at all. In fact, the Obama health care policy is not really a social democratic policy. It had to make its compromises, substantial compromises, with the private health insurance industry. He did the best he could, but it's certainly not socialized medicine. It's not an NHS. Still, I think the appointment of Ryan to the ticket will sharpen the ideological character of the campaign.
But are you not worried with some of the views that you yourself have expressed about how we should go on from this economic recession?
Well, I'm worried in the sense that I don't think that the outcome of the election, the presidential election, is by any means a foregone conclusion. Because the economy is weak and because Obama has lost these past 4 years a lot of the moral and civic idealism that fueled his first campaign, I think this could be a very close election, and I think it's very difficult to predict the outcome. I would say it's about 50-50. I think it'll go back and forth. So I'm not confident about the outcome of the election, but it could be interesting if we have a clear philosophical, ideological debate, which would be better than the kind of purely campaign of personal insults, which often afflicts campaigns like these. We'll be right back.
great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.